the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The issue of reproductive technologies is kind of front and center in the American attention from time to time, but when it comes to a particular couple or family, it can be front and center in a very urgent way. As I look at the emails and questions I receive, the numbers of questions that come to me when I'm speaking at a conference or in a local church, when I am out in the public, I will tell you that questions related to ART, or assisted reproductive technologies, are among the most common. Now, the New York Times has done us a tremendous service, an outstanding series of articles in the New York Times. It started on Sunday, and the reporting is absolutely stellar, dealing with the consequences, often unknown by persons who get involved with these reproductive technologies. There are some sweet stories, there are some heartbreaking stories, and there are some huge moral issues involved in the articles published on Sunday and Monday in the New York Times. And, you know, when you start looking at a news coverage series like this, you realize a major American newspaper, and indeed the most influential of all, I would argue, the New York Times, now sees an ethical and moral crisis related to reproductive technology. Now, let me give you a hint. It's not the same crisis I see, but it's not entirely unrelated to where, from a Christian worldview, many of us have deep-seated concerns. I think you're going to find this interesting. This is going to be a discussion today about the unintended consequences of these assisted reproductive technologies and what it means. Very hard decisions that are being made by couples and families about reproduction. And I want to start out by saying, as we will get to this conversation in just a moment, the desire for a child for a married couple is extremely righteous. It's not only understandable, it's right and righteous. But there are limits to what any Christian couple can do in seeking to have a child by assisted reproductive technologies. And I think there are many Christian parents who've really never thought about this. And this is the angle of my greatest concern right now. I hear from Christian couples who tell me, it's not just what we think about this, it's what our parents think about this as they desire to be grandparents. It's what our siblings and our friends and our peers think about this. There's a lot of pressure on these couples from within and from without. We're going to be talking about it today on the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some other issues in the news. There is big news out of California. It's big news, at least as you look at the news coverage. It may not seem like that big a story, but it's getting a lot of coverage coast to coast. The headline in the Boston Globe, on the other side of the continent from California, is this: Schwarzenegger creates day honoring Harvey Milk. The lead paragraph of the Associated Press story says, slain gay rights activist Harvey Milk will get a special day of recognition in California, making him only the second person in state history, in addition to conservationist John Muir, to gain such a designation. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, signed the bill, and on each May 22nd, Harvey Milk's birthday, the state's public schools are expected to spend a day of observation. It's not a holiday. They're going to be in school, but they are encouraged, as schools and as teachers, to make a focus on gay rights, a major issue on that day. Now, when you look at Harvey Milk, let's just remember that he was indeed slain. One of the weirdest criminal trials followed. That's the infamous Twinkie defense. But what we're talking about here is someone who is now being held up as an exemplar for the children of California and for the public schools as they consider the issue of homosexuality. Now, the Associated Press reports Harvey Milk Day will not be a formal state holiday, so government employees will not be given the day off. The bill instead calls for the day to be observed by public schools as a day of special significance. Teachers will be encouraged to conduct exercises recalling Milk's life and contributions to the state. Very interesting. State Senator Mark Leno, who wrote the bill, said Milk was a human rights leader in the same way Cesar Chavez championed Hispanic farm workers and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. sought equal treatment for blacks. It's really, really, really interesting. When you look at this, Randy Thomason said, quote, sadly, children in public schools will now have even more in-your-face homosexual, bisexual, transsexual indoctrination. Well, Mr. Thomason, you're undoubtedly right, and that is the point. That is absolutely the point. These special days become a means of educational propaganda. And there is a very clear edge to this. By the way, a spokesperson for the governor said that undoubtedly there was the influence of additional attention to Harvey Milk based upon the Academy Award-winning movie that came out last year about his life, a movie starring Sean Penn. It's just another reminder that Hollywood has an angle, Hollywood has an influence, and Hollywood has an agenda. And in this case, in the state that is the home to Hollywood, now the public schools are even to a greater degree sharing that agenda. And I just want to remind you that this means that the students who are in those schools are going to be subjected to a very ideologically driven message about gay rights in a day that is now, as a result of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's signature, now the law of the land in California. I just want to tell you one other issue. This isn't in any of the press reports. This is just from my experience. When you put a date like this on the calendar, it begins to grow in significance. It's going to be seized as an opportunity to push this agenda in multitudinous ways. And there you have it from California. One of the questions, I guess, will be where next? Very interesting news coverage on the international arena. And my guess is that many among you have either not heard of this or not perhaps thought it was important. A long and very bitter feud between the nations of Turkey and Armenia is showing signs of a promising thaw as the presidents of those two countries signed a pact to normalize relations. Now, folks, I am fascinated by this. The historian in me says this is one of the most interesting news stories I've seen in a very long time. There was, in the early years of the 20th century, a horrible act of murderous atrocity against Armenian people who were in what is now called Turkey. And the Armenian people have pressed for years for this to be declared internationally a genocide. And it is a matter of national desperation, indeed of a national cause for the Armenian people, that they have this declared a genocide because they believe that will give a greater moral validity to their claims about what went on and a greater moral status to the lives of those snuffed out in the last days of the Ottoman Empire. But that's the point, isn't it? We're talking here about what, by almost any moral designation, should be classed as a genocide because it was an intentional ethnic cleansing of persons who were driven out of the land and in many cases abused and murdered simply because of their Armenian ethnicity. But it was done in the last years of the Ottoman Empire. As the Ottoman Empire was coming to an end, folks, you talk about history. Do you realize that this is less than 100 years ago? Within the span of a conceivable lifetime of persons hearing my voice right now, there was an Ottoman Empire. There was an empire of an Islamic caliphate and sultanate there in the town that had been known as Constantinople and then as Istanbul. And even as it had included a vast amount of the world's terrain at a certain point, by the point of the early 20th century, it had been restricted to Asia Minor and some neighboring areas. But the end of World War I meant the end of the Ottoman Empire because the Ottoman powers had sided with the losing side, that is, with Germany and its allies of the Central Powers in the First World War. And so history does come round and round. This is just a reminder to us of something that I hope you think about from time to time, and that is that history has consequences. You know, Henry Ford famously said, history is nothing more than one thing after another. In other words, it's irrelevant. It isn't irrelevant. History's around us all the time. There are national grievances that go back for centuries. There is wounded pride on the part of nations that goes back for centuries and generations. There are historical occurrences that change the lives and set trajectories for lives today that people do not recognize. But for too long, the peoples of Turkey and Armenia have been facing off over the issue of an estrangement, we would say, for moral cause. We've had the Armenians demanding a tribunal and indeed the nation of Turkey, a modern state, admit the genocide that took place. Meanwhile, in Turkey, it is a crime against Turkishness. Yes, that's a crime against Turkishness to even talk about this much in public. Folks, let me tell you, human beings are capable of incalculable evil. human conflicts are often so intractable and difficult to work out. But I want to tell you what took place as Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton observed the signing of this now normalization of relations between Turkey and Armenia. What took place there is a sign that human beings can sometimes do the right thing and can sometimes eventually move even beyond history to something better. Just think about the fact that 20 years ago we were talking about horrible daily headlines from Northern Ireland, and the people there finally had enough, and maybe the people of Turkey and Armenia have finally had enough as well. There are big moral questions still to be answered, but as for this news story, there's also ground for hope. Don't miss it. We're going to be back to talk about assisted reproductive technologies and all the moral issues they bring. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Assisted reproductive technologies are a huge issue, not only medically and as this reform of healthcare now being proposed in Washington takes shape. One of the big questions is, of course, what kinds of things will be covered and why? One of the moral complications of the whole issue over assisted reproduction is indeed the question of cost and insurance coverage and all the rest, and decisions made by coverage questions and by insurance coverers to decide what exactly they're going to cover and not. That means there's an incentive for certain kinds of procedures and a disincentive for others. Let's kind of track this through a little bit. The source of our conversation today is really sparked by Stephanie Saul's two-article series in the New York Times. It ran Sunday and Monday. And if you saw Sunday's edition of the New York Times, I mean, there aren't too many times that you look at this newspaper's front page and think that's really tender and sweet, but a full-color picture on this Sunday edition of the New York Times of two little baby boys in little matching Easter pails with little stuffed animals beside them, and they're undoubtedly adorable. And you are drawn into this story. They are the Mastera twins. That is Max and Wes. They were born to Jeff and Carrie Mastera. They had gone through numerous fertility and reproductive procedures before eventually using in vitro fertilization or IVF in order to conceive these boys. However, their birth was extremely complicated because there was not just one baby in the womb, but two. The normal gestation, which is 40 weeks for a single baby, is down to 35 weeks for most twins on average. Nevertheless, when they came quite early, the babies were born, these two little boys, by IVF conception. They were born at 3 pounds, 1 ounce, kept alive in a neonatal intensive care unit. Max remained in the hospital 43 days. Wes came home in 51 days. By the time it was over, medical bills for the boys exceeded $1.2 million. A couple of interesting things here. Stephanie Saul did a very fine job. I want to give hats off here to the New York Times. Kudos to this reporter and to the paper for a very worthy series of articles. So much of the coverage on this is very superficial. This isn't. This really gets to it. It's very human, dealing with the human angle here, with anguished parents so hopeful to have children, and with parents who finally have their children, now so thankful for them, but also distressed when medical issues do often arise. Very interesting coverage. Listen to what she says here. She says, this is Stephanie Saul's writing the New York Times, like many other twins can see through in vitro fertilization, the Mastera boys will go down in the record books as a success, both for the fertility clinic that helped create them and the neonatologist who nursed them to health. But an exploration of the fertility industry reveals that the success comes with a price. While IVF creates thousands of new families a year, an increasing number of the newborns are twins, and they carry special risks often overlooked in the desire to produce babies. Both these little boys are really, really tiny, below normal birth weight. They are both extremely vulnerable preemies. Now listen, the fertility industry has guidelines, but as Stephanie Sauls reports, many fertility doctors routinely ignore their industry's own guidelines, which encourage the use of single embryos during in vitro fertilization. Some doctors say that powerful financial incentives hold sway in a competitive marketplace. Placing extra embryos in a woman's womb increases the chances that one will take. The resulting babies and word of mouth can be the best way of luring new business, that is, to a fertility clinic. All right, so what's going on here? Well, I'll tell you what's going on here. The issue of in vitro fertilization is no longer on the margins of our society. It's now a normalized part of reproductive health technologies, and it's accessible to thousands and thousands of couples who desperately seek babies. And the whole idea of an in vitro conception is that indeed the sperm and the egg meet outside of the womb, and the in vitro simply means in glass in a laboratory setting, and then fertilized embryos are then transferred into the woman's womb. And because of cost issues, it generally is not just one embryo, although that is the guideline now called for by the professional organizations, but rather multiple embryos. At one time, it was multiple in terms of a handful of them, as many as five or six. But now it's generally not one, but two. As a matter of fact, at one point, I was looking at a report that said just 5% of IVF procedures involve the transfer of only one embryo. This means that when you have the transfer of multiple embryos, you are bringing on the likelihood of multiple problems. Okay, so what's in the background of this? We have a huge issue here. Do you believe that this embryo is a human being made in the image of God? And I hope you do, because if you do not, then you're going to have to arbitrarily come up with some point at which you're all of a sudden going to decide that this human's a human. And the reality is that the in vitro fertilization revolution has led to the creation of hundreds of thousands and now almost surely over a million, quote, excess human embryos that are simply going to be thawed and destroyed, and that means they're going to die. And so one of the side effects of this birth control revolution is that we have all of these embryos, and then it gets worse from there. And so as people think about in vitro fertilization, they often think, well, that's a great thing. People who couldn't have babies can now have babies. And I want you to know I celebrate the birth of every single baby to every married couple. I think that is a wonderful thing. I'm thankful for it. I'm thankful that they want a baby. That's a righteous desire. But one of the things we better settle in our minds is whether or not that means that every single technology is justified simply because it might lead to a successful pregnancy, or for that matter, even just a pregnancy and the potential for a baby's birth. Now, why is all this really important? Well, I'll tell you, the New York Times is concerned about this because of money. In my opening comment, I said that their concern is not irrelevant, but it's not my concern. Their concern primarily is money. With the healthcare discussion going on and all the rest, they're saying, look, there are so many costs with this. Did you hear that these Mastera twins cost $1.2 million by the time they got the boys home from the hospital? That's $1.2 million. Now, if you talk about thousands of IVF procedures leading to thousands of babies' births per year, you can count on those costs pretty much adding a tremendous burden to the total medical spending and, of course, to insurance plans and all the rest. Insurance plays into this. We'll talk about more in just a moment. But right now, what I want you to see is that there are tremendous moral questions here. Because if indeed, on the one hand, you have the availability of this in vitro fertilization, and on the other hand, you have the fact that there is an economic incentive for doctors and fertility clinics to transfer more than one embryo. And by the way, this article is so very important in showing that this is a competitive business, as they say, as the would-be parents, if they think this clinic is not so successful in terms of the sheer number or percentage of conceptions that lead to successful transfers that lead to successful births, then they'll go elsewhere. So keeping them from going elsewhere means that they want to raise their percentage of successful pregnancies by just adding more embryos to the mix. And when you do that, then you have the problem of having, if the implantation is successful, multiple babies in the womb. Well, you put multiple babies in the womb and you end up with a crowded womb, which leads to premature births and all kinds of health issues for those preemies and all kinds of medical costs. So when you get to Monday's article from the New York Times, there you meet the fact that medical practitioners are calling for what's called a selective reduction. Folks, that's abortion. How many Americans realize that in a large number of these cases, the use of IVF leads to abortion? It leads to the, quote, selective reduction. How do you like that language? Whereby someone is deciding this fetus will live and this fetus will die. Folks, this is where the moral issues are unavoidable. And I want to know what you think about it. From a Christian perspective, what are your thoughts? Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Mail at mail@albertmoeller.com. Follow us at Facebook at the Albert Mueller Program, Twitter/Albert Mueller. And hang on, because we'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The second article in this New York Times series is really, really interesting because it talks about a procedure known as intrauterine insemination, and it turns out that what we've known for a long time is that insurance companies are often requiring this to be done, if not once, then several times, in order to try to use a lower cost effort to try to gain a pregnancy. It's kind of something that is required often before moving on to in vitro fertilization, but it requires a woman to take hormone shots and then for the semen to be injected into her. What happens then is that there is a tremendously high likelihood of a multiple pregnancy. And in the story that was revealed here, they really follow a case very, very clearly. And there were six babies born, and there are only three that survived. They are all now in the neonatal intensive care unit. Their futures are unclear. One of them, a little girl, is near death. And again, this is a couple that rejected the call for selective reduction. And it just tells you, again, where the medical community is on this. The selective reduction makes sense to this particular fertility enterprise because it leads to the likelihood of a healthier baby. But just think about this. At what moral cost? You're talking about what is, by any definition, abortion. And, you know, calling it selective reduction doesn't make it anything other than what it is. It's the killing of certain fetuses in order to allow others to grow to a larger birth weight through gestation. The phone number to call is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Grand Island, Nebraska, where Sean's on the line listening on KMMJ. Go ahead, Sean.
Oh, Dr. Mohler. I talked to you a little while back. I'm the gentleman that has quadruplets.
Yeah.
Yeah. When my wife and I went through it, we didn't go through in vitro, but my wife was given a shot of progesterone.
Yeah.
Released more than one egg. And when we got up to that point, the doctor said, came to us and he said, well, I'm not morally obligated, but I'm legally obligated to have to ask you if you'd want to consider selective reduction. When my wife and I looked at each other and I said, is he asking? I think he's asking. And he said, yeah. And we said, well, you know, we had worked very hard to get up to that point. We thought, you know, we couldn't see ourselves being put into that moral situation where you had to decide
right.
who lived and who died.
Right. Well, you know, Sean, I guess what would be most helpful to you, and by the way, God bless you for your determination, your wife's determination. I think I can identify with your sense of shock when you said, is that what we're really being asked to do? And let's just be very, very blunt. What you're asking to do is to abort some of those babies that that now you get to hold in your arms. But Sean, let me just ask you, as you think about this in retrospect, what kind of moral advice would you want to communicate to couples that are considering this kind of technology?
Well, in hindsight, we didn't realize, we didn't think about the ramifications of playing God and finding out that, you know, by doing so, you were being blessed with more than one child. But once we crossed that proverbial bridge, we couldn't find ourselves to even consider, you know, to have to answer that sort of a moral question of who would live and who would die. And I didn't want to, you know, face my maker in the end. And
right.
You know, but yeah, you made that decision and you shouldn't have.
Well, I think what's really, really helpful in your first-person testimony, Sean, is the fact that, and I love the way you started it, is by saying that you really hadn't contemplated this before. That's why we're having this conversation. I think it could help a lot of parents, a lot of couples out there who desperately want to be parents, to think this issue through. Sean, before I let you go, let me ask you, how are the babies doing?
Oh, they're great. They're 7 years old now.
They're not babies anymore. They're 7 years old. That's phenomenal. And I can only imagine your joy. And I'm just so thankful that you have these children. I want you to understand that. You know, it's like any other situation. The moral status of the children is never in question. And they are an unalloyed, undiluted, good, wonderful, precious, infinitely wonderful gift to you and to your wife. One of the things we really need to help people think about is what they will and will not be willing to do. Where, in terms of your Christian worldview commitments, do you find the line between what you would and would not do? When we come back, we're going to talk about how insurance companies, medical practitioners, the professional guilds, and all the rest really kind of conspire to make some of those decisions before you may ever get to. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Interesting discussion about the ramifications and issues related to the use of assisted reproductive technologies. Folks, we're going to take a call that's kind of unprecedented on this program. It's a call from tomorrow. Someone calling from across the dateline, 6:40 a.m. on Wednesday. It is in Okinawa, Japan. Dana's on the line, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Dana.
Good morning. Well, I'm sorry. Good afternoon for you, Dr. Mueller.
Thank you.
My wife and I, I'm a physician. My wife and I began the process of enlisting reproductive technology about 4 years ago. We went through diagnostics. We did some hormone supplementation. We did IUI. We actually attempted embryo adoption. And then after not having any success with all of that, we began to talk about and pray about IVF. And I was knowing, I've been listening to your program for a long time. I read about this stuff. I'm very concerned about bioethics. I know the manufacturing process that reproduction has become in America. I wanted nothing to do with it. And so we came to the agreement, my wife and I, of two eggs, two embryos. We were ready to have two children. More than that would put us in the situation of really a double-mindedness of saying,
right.
Yeah, I want these children, but I'm really not ready for them. And I can't go before God and say, can you kill one of them because we're not ready for three or four or five. And so we were very deliberate with our doctors here in Okinawa that we wanted two embryos. And the morning that we went in, on a Monday morning, they harvested the eggs. On Thursday morning, we went in for the embryo transfer. And in the handoff from one doctor to another, seven eggs were fertilized, and we had seven embryos.
Wow.
And my wife and I looked at each other, and the exact situation that I had deliberately planned to avoid in a desire to be as godly about this as I could was given to me. And my wife is an amazing and godly woman, and she said, God's going to give us the grace for what he's going to give us. And, you know, we've proceeded with this. Unfortunately, we've done two transfers of two embryos. None of those four babies have lived. We have three more that we're waiting to transfer next month. And so, again, God is sovereign and has a bigger plan. But and this is at a Christian hospital here in Okinawa. And we've had similar experiences along the way with people who are either these are Christian healthcare providers or at Christian hospitals or clinics. But there's a distinct lack of real biblical thought about what's going on here.
Clearly.
You know, an embryologist tells me, well, the probability is that, you know, not all three are going to survive. I understand probability. God's not about probability. You know, it's there's a disconnect between being a Christian and a doctor and being a Christian doctor.
You know, Dana, I've rarely had a call that has that's just grabbed me as much as yours has, and I'd love to have you on just talk about the difference between being a Christian who's a doctor and a Christian doctor, and I understand that, but let me just tell you, number one, I am so thankful for your conviction and your worldview and your confidence in Christ your absolute confidence in God and his sovereignty. And I hope there are persons who are hearing this conversation right now who realize that you and your wife did everything that is possible to make your instructions clear. And as you said in the handoff, and I don't know if there are medical ethical issues there or just communication issues there, but you know, once you had, and I just wanted to hear you say it, but once you had seven embryos, you have seven embryos, and thus you have seven embryos, each one of them a human being made in the image of God. And you now have three. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, Dana, I'm going to pray that the Lord, you know, in the scripture, especially the story of Joseph, we have a very clear principle that is important for us to understand. It goes all the way pointing to Christ. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And even though this went against your wishes, I'm going to pray the Lord will use this for good, in the sense the Lord will give you a child by means of this. And I'm absolutely confident from the conviction I've heard in your voice that you're going to have all of those embryos transferred. But I just, with time so short, I wish we had a lot more time. Dana, I just want to ask you, and by the way, I want you to hold on so we can get your address. The staff will get this in just a moment. But let me ask you, what would be your urgent advice to other Christian couples considering this kind of technology? You've got a credibility, first of all, as a doctor, but secondly, just given your stories you related to here, what would be your urgent advice?
I don't think that there is an inherent evil in this technology. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. I would encourage people to have a written plan of exactly what they want, and that you have a team meeting with the doctor, the embryologist, all the people that are going to be involved in the process, so that everyone knows from a written document what it is your intentions are. You're never going to completely eliminate confusion, but that should reduce it as much as possible. Have a written document that everyone sees,
Dana.
And it's not about a lawsuit. That's not the issue. The issue is so that we're all clear on our intentions.
That is extremely prudent and helpful advice. And I would just like to come behind that and say that I believe any Christian couple contemplating the use of any assisted reproductive technology, certainly if it's intrauterine insemination or whether you're talking about in vitro fertilization, there must be an absolute determination to transfer every single embryo. And not necessarily at the same time, but eventually the couple must be ready to receive every single embryo as a child and to transfer every single embryo. And then on the other side of the transfer, to be willing to reduce none. An absolute unwillingness to have any reduction. And, you know, the New York Times series is primarily concerned about medical ethics and then, to an even greater degree, the money involved. But I'll tell you, far more expensive than anything measured in money is the moral cost of careless and, frankly, disastrous decisions related to these assisted reproductive technologies. Dana, thank you so much for your call. Please hold on so you can give information to the folks here, the production staff. Folks, this is really important. And I think as you heard this doctor's voice calling from Japan, you heard words that we desperately, desperately need to hear and think about. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Fascinating and important. Jamel wrote to say that he believes that Christians should stay away from reproductive technologies that destroy fertilized eggs. Amen. Absolutely. Because let's talk about what a fertilized egg is. A fertilized egg, by the way, one of the medical evasions here these days is called a pre-embryo. It's an embryo, any way you want to look at it. And it is a human being. And again, if you don't believe that, then you're going to have to come make some compelling case for how you know when along the progressive sequence of development, all of a sudden, this human becomes a human. If you don't take it back all the way to the point of conception, then you are arbitrarily coming up with something, by the way, that morally you can't live with. We'll have to keep that conversation's extension for another time. Stan wrote in to ask, is it wrong to use these methods of reproducing ourselves? Is it a defiance of God's providential gift of children, as in Abraham begetting Ishmael? I don't think it's the same thing, Stan. For one thing, what you were looking at with the Abraham story of Ishmael, it involved everything from going to a woman who was outside the covenant people of God, a woman who was not his wife. It goes on and on and on. A slave to Sarah. It's a very convoluted story. But, you know, your question has a lot of moral sense. I love Stan's question because it shows someone who's asking, is this just a natural barrier we're not to go beyond? I believe there are those barriers. You heard Dana say that doesn't there's anything inherently wrong with the technology. I would say the only question there is the abstraction of reproduction from the context of the marital act. But I would say that's not a convincing, clinching argument either way. But I would come back and say that the kind of advice you heard from Dana and that I followed up with is the advice you better know what you're getting into. You better have, well, I love his suggestion of written guidelines and stipulations that are well agreed as kind of a contract with those who'll be conducting the medical portions, laboratory portions of the reproductive technology. I think beyond that, you just have to be absolutely committed to know that you're going to receive every single embryo as a child and you're going to treat every single embryo as a child. Which means you implant all and you reduce none. A very, very interesting caller that we were not able to take, that we lost, called in to say she has a friend that has frozen embryos. She considers them all her children. You know, I have no idea exactly what she may have meant by that. I wish we'd been able to have her on because this is the question I'd want to ask. Would she allow any of her children to remain in a permanently frozen state? In danger of thawing and dying and almost surely one day to be discarded? Well, if she really does believe that they are her children, I think we're in good shape. I think she will, by force of that very important moral logic, have to welcome them being implanted and hope that they are born. If not, then she doesn't really think of them as her children. But I think for certain they are. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.